Thank you for downloading this podcast of The World at One from BBC Radio 4.
The World at One. This is James Robbins with 45 minutes of news and comment. Hello. The Prime Minister has said he'll continue to argue for a robust response to Syria's use of chemical weapons, even though British military action has been ruled out following last night's parliamentary vote.
Parliament has spoken very, very clearly about military involvement. That doesn't stop us condemning chemical weapons. It doesn't stop us condemning the Assad regime. It doesn't stop us working with allies to bring the maximum pressure on this regime and the appalling things that it's doing.
Alistair Burt, the Foreign Office Minister responsible for Syria, will join me live on the programme. Meanwhile, France has said it remains prepared to take part in a military strike and will explore the possible damage last night's vote could have caused to Britain's special relationship with the United States. And
between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet and Nobel Prize laureate, has died at the age of 74. First, the BBC News is read for us by Alan Smith.
David Cameron has said Britain will continue to provide what he called a robust response to the suspected chemical weapons attack in Syria last week, despite the Commons vote last night against military involvement. The surprise defeat for the Prime Minister saw 30 Conservative MPs and 9 Liberal Democrats join Labour in rejecting the principle of taking military action against the regime. Speaking in Downing Street, Mr Cameron said it was a regret that he'd been unable to build a consensus. From Westminster, here's our political correspondent, Ross Hawkins.
David Cameron argued that while Britain would not take part in military strikes against Syria, it would still act and there should be a robust response to President Assad. British diplomats would continue to make a case at the United Nations, he said, and to work with international organisations. He rejected a suggestion that he would have to apologise to President Obama for last night's vote, arguing that while he had a strong view, it was right to listen to Parliament. The Prime Minister said Britain remained deeply engaged in the world. But earlier, the Chancellor George Osborne said there would be national soul-searching about its global role and added he hoped this would not become the moment when it turned its back on the world's problems. The former Liberal Democrat leader Lord Ashdown struck a more despairing tone, saying in 50 years he had never felt so depressed and ashamed, and last night's vote had left the UK a hugely diminished country. Labour's leader Ed Miliband said there should be greater diplomatic, political and humanitarian efforts to help the Syrian people.
Russia has welcomed the British vote against military action on Syria. A spokesman for President Putin said it showed people were beginning to understand the dangers of such an attack. The US, however, has played down the vote, saying it would continue to act in what it called its best interests. In Europe, Germany has ruled out participation in a military strike. In contrast, President Hollande said France may still take part, saying it was up to each nation to make its own decision. From Paris, Hugh Schofield.
Till now, France and Britain have worked in tandem on the Syrian dossier, but with the Commons vote, their paths are diverging. President Hollande made clear in his interview with Le Monde that whatever change of heart there may have been in London, Paris remains committed to the view that those who carried out the chemical weapons attack need to be punished. If they're not, he said, then there's a risk that the use of chemical weapons in Syria and elsewhere could come to be seen as something normal. France, he said, was one of the few countries with the capacity to inflict the necessary punishment, and it remained ready to act. It's a significant moment. The French, traditionally suspicious of the Americans, poised to join them in a military coalition, while Washington's special partner, the UK, watches from the sidelines.
The United Nations inspectors are completing their investigations in Syria by visiting a military hospital where victims of chemical attacks are reportedly being treated. The UN team is due to leave Syria tomorrow morning and will give an initial report to the UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon. Our Middle East correspondent Kevin Connolly has been following developments from the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
The UN inspectors' mission in Damascus is entering its final phase. They've been visiting a hospital in a government-controlled area of the city. Their departure and the expected delivery of their preliminary findings to the UN shortly afterwards are seen as possible triggers for any American-led military action. In the wider world, the British parliamentary decision to stay out of any such operation is of huge diplomatic significance, leaving the United States without a degree of political cover and cooperation on which it normally relies. In the Middle East, the issue is viewed slightly differently. Here, attention will focus on the scale, intensity and the targets of any attack, and not on the nationality of the armed forces which deliver them.
The Brazilian partner of a Guardian journalist who was detained for 9 hours at Heathrow has agreed to allow officials to continue to examine documents that were seized from him. David Miranda still plans to challenge his detention. From the High Court, here's Jane Peel.
The police and intelligence agencies can continue to examine the material seized from David Miranda in order to protect national security and as part of a criminal investigation into whether any terrorist or official secrets offences have been committed. A witness statement given to the court revealed more details of the government's case. It said Mr. Miranda's computer hard drive contained 58,000 highly classified UK intelligence documents. The statement said the material included personal information that could identify intelligence officers overseas, and it was possible it was already in the hands of foreign states. David Miranda's solicitor described the government's assessment as sweeping and vague and claimed the assertions were unfounded.
The poet and Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney has died in hospital in Dublin at the age of 74. He'd been unwell for some time. One of his most famous books was a translation of the epic Anglo-Saxon poem Beowulf. His other works often dealt with rural and parochial life in Ireland, particularly the north. Here's Nick Higham.
Seamus Heaney was internationally recognised as the greatest Irish poet since W.B. Yeats. The son of a farmer in the rural heart of Northern Ireland, he wrote often about his childhood and about the community from which he came. He wrote, too, about turf bogs, about the natural world and about personal relationships. It was Northern Ireland's troubles that made him famous and sometimes controversial. He was a Catholic and a nationalist who chose to live in the South after 1972. "Be advised, my passport's green," he once wrote. "No glass of ours was ever raised to toast the Queen." But he always condemned violence and its effects. Famous Seamus, some called him, a renowned translator and an accomplished broadcaster, whose books became bestsellers.
Nick Higham reporting on the death of Seamus Heaney, which was announced this morning. It's rare for MPs to have the power they wielded last night, the power not only to defeat a Prime Minister, but also to change Britain's foreign policy utterly. Members of Parliament did have that power 10 years ago, it's true, but they backed Tony Blair over non-existent weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This time they've rejected David Cameron's impassioned argument for a limited military response to actual weapons of mass destruction in Syria. What does this mean for the people of that country, tortured, killed, or at the very least traumatised by more than 2 years of conflict which has shredded their country? Could Britain's withdrawal from possible US-led strikes undermine President Obama's position, seeking a coalition to demonstrate international outrage at the use of chemical weapons? And what does the Commons vote mean for the Prime Minister, his government, and the entire balance of power between the executive and the legislature in this country? We'll examine those questions this afternoon. But first, the Prime Minister David Cameron, speaking this morning, made it clear that Britain will not take part in any military action against Syria after last night's vote.
British Parliament has spoken very, very clearly about its views about military involvement. That doesn't stop us condemning chemical weapons. It doesn't stop us condemning the Assad regime. It doesn't stop us working with allies to bring the maximum pressure on this regime and the appalling things that it's doing. But on the specific issue of British military action, I think that was the message of the debate.
And the man who inflicted defeat on the Prime Minister, the leader of the opposition, Ed Miliband, has been expanding this morning on the reasons why he took that course and why he thinks Conservative and Liberal Democrat rebels voted with him.
I think if Britain had engaged in a rush to war on an ill-thought-through basis, not working with the international community, not going through the United Nations, that would have been bad for our country and bad for the people of Syria as well. We must learn the lessons of Iraq about the way we go about any action that we undertake. But military action is now off the agenda for Britain. What we must do, though, is not abandon the people of Syria. We must step up the efforts we make to put the pressure on President Assad through non-military means, the political and diplomatic efforts that are required.
Ed Miliband. Well, to examine the historical significance and future significance of what's just happened, I've been speaking to Philip Cowley, Professor of Parliamentary Government at the University of Nottingham. First, to what extent was last night's parliamentary defeat unprecedented?
Well, there aren't really many precedents in modern times. And the fact that the examples that are being discussed involve Lord Aberdeen, Lord Palmerston and Lord North, I think, gives you an example of the length of time you've got to go back till you can find anything broadly comparable.
In fact, how far back is that?
Well, you're talking 18th, 19th century. Nothing in the 20th century is comparable with this. And a part of the reason for that, though, is that we didn't used to have these pre-military action votes in the way that we have had since 2003. I can't find any example of a government wanting to go into military action and then losing the vote on that in the House of Commons.
If what happened last night is, in your view, historically unprecedented, how did this come about? Is it because somehow Parliament has got more powerful? Most people don't think that's the case.
Oh, I think there's no doubt Parliament's becoming more powerful. I think two things really explain last night's vote. You had an opposition that was prepared to vote against the government. That has not been true in votes on military action or defence votes, really, since Suez in 1956. And so if you go back 10 years and look at Iraq, you had a huge rebellion of Labour MPs, but the Conservative Party was supporting the government. And bluntly, if the official opposition and the government support something, then there's almost no likelihood, however big the rebellion, that you won't get your way.
Does the transformational change, which you seem to be talking about, imply that the position of Prime Minister has been greatly weakened in the long term?
Well, I think, but the second thing which is really important is that you also had Conservative MPs, so government MPs prepared to rebel and to defeat the government over this. And again, that's unprecedented. And that's part of a growing independence of MPs, both Labour and Conservative, a growing willingness to vote against their government. I think it certainly makes government harder. 40, 50, 60 years ago, Prime Ministers did not have to come to the House of Commons and ask for permission to take part in military interventions. They do now, and we, as we saw last night, sometimes the House of Commons will say no.
But as Professor of Parliamentary Government, does this, in your view, change Britain's entire relationship with the outside world?
No, I think it changes it depending on the views of the official opposition and the backbenchers of the governing party. I think the idea that last night changes the way Britain interacts with the world for good, I think, is foolish. It's quite easy to see Britain taking part in military action again. Recently, we voted for military action in Libya, and only a very small number of MPs rebelled against that decision. So I don't think it changes it for good, but it makes governing, it makes the process of the Prime Minister wanting to do that much, much tougher.
Professor Philip Cowley on the growing power of Parliament. Well, one of those who exercised that power last night is the former Shadow Home Secretary and one-time Tory leadership contender David Davis. He voted against the government's motion, and he explained to me why.
I'm not an anti-interventionist, but in my view, intervention has got to have a clear purpose, a decent chance of succeeding, and you've got to be able to at least calculate what the risks of it all going wrong are. And really, none of those criteria were met in the debate yesterday.
But the Prime Minister was absolutely clear. There is, he believes, a clear moral imperative to enforce a global ban on chemical weapons use.
Well, that actually wasn't how it was presented. I mean, what he said was that they couldn't prove it outright. He used the word a matter of judgment several times. And that's really quite a shaky argument when you're going to kill people. I mean, you know, you may be killing conscript soldiers, you may accidentally be killing civilians, but you're going to kill people. And you're intervening in a way which may lead to reaction, either by the Syrians themselves, the Assad regime itself, or by its allies. I mean, one of the things that's happened in the run-up to this is, of course, the Russians have provided air defense. Why did Putin say he was doing that? In order to prevent external intervention, foreign intervention in this civil war. So what would his reaction be if he turned around and said, OK, every time you knock out a system, I'll replace it and more than replace it? We'll end up feeding the war, hurting and killing more civilians over a longer period rather than stopping it and saving the civilians from the consequences of the Assad regime.
Could the Prime Minister have changed your mind and won this vote if he had simply taken things more slowly and adopted a different timetable?
There was this feeling of rushing to action. Given all of the mistakes we've made in the last 10 or 15 years, all the wars we've gone into thinking it was absolutely right in the first day and finding out within a year or two we've got it completely wrong, it's more important to get this right than to do it on a 10-day timetable.
David Davis, you think there could be terrible unintended consequences from any British participation in strikes on Syria. couldn't there be equally terrible unintended consequences from not acting, especially if President Assad judges that he's successfully divided and therefore can rule the international community?
There are consequences for all actions and inactions. And, of course, there's a host of things, diplomatic and economic, that we should do. We should be working much harder to force both sides to the negotiating table. So we should be talking to the Saudis and Qataris who are supporting them and saying, get them to negotiate. There are 101 things that need to be done. I just don't think this is one of them.
Have those who rebelled against David Cameron dealt a terrible blow to his authority, to your party, to this government?
The truth of the matter is, when it's a life and death issue, people must vote on their consciences. Now, of course it's a setback for David, and that's unfortunate, and I wish that were not so. But if I have to choose between a policy which might lead to massive numbers of unforeseen deaths and a slight embarrassment to the party, well, I'll take that. He'll recover from it. We'll have forgotten this in a few weeks' time in those terms.
The Conservative MP David Davis, and later will be joined by Foreign Office Minister Alastair Burt, who I hope will tell us about the government's future strategy on Syria. But as MPs began casting their votes last night, they would have missed one of the most harrowing pieces of reportage on this increasingly grotesque conflict. The BBC's Ian Pannell reported on television and radio the aftermath of an attack by Syrian government forces in Aleppo in northern Syria. An incendiary bomb containing a napalm-like substance had been dropped on a school, killing at least 10 children and leaving many more with burns so shocking and extensive they were unlikely to survive.
A scene of just complete chaos and devastation here. Casualties just keep on coming in. You can hear the screams of the women as they're trying to administer care. The truth is, they can't even barely begin to cope inside here. There are a few beds, which is why people laid out on the floor. The smell that's in the air, it's a sickening smell of burning flesh. It's an absolutely horrific scene.
Ian Pannell reporting from northern Syria for Panorama. He also spoke to Dr. Rola from the British charity Hand in Hand in Syria. She treated some of the victims.
I feel so angry right now. I feel so, so angry. The whole world has been watching us for 2.5 years. We feel like some sort of, not even a second-class citizen. We just don't matter. Like, all of these children and all of these people who are being killed and massacred, we don't matter. The whole world has failed our nation. And it's innocent civilians who are paying the price.
And I've been speaking to one of Dr. Rola's colleagues, Fadi Alderi. He's operations director for Hand in Hand, British-born but with Syrian parents. Fadi Alderi is just over the border from Syria and Turkey. What's his response to the attack?
I won't be able to comment on the either sides. I mean, to me, it's like, why would anybody use it on their people? And most of the injured, most of the dead are under the age of 20.
Do you see any prospect of this conflict being ended?
No. I mean, it won't end before another 2-3 years' time. I mean, now we're looking at death. I think the official one is well over 100,000. But then, obviously, the unofficial figure is much, much higher than that. I mean, with the orphans, just Hand in Hand for Syria, we have so many orphans we support. We're talking about thousands. And we are only like doing a drop in the ocean. There are so many organizations helping the orphans.
Do you think the outside world has a responsibility to protect civilians in Syria, has a responsibility to act, whatever action is taken? Does it have a responsibility to get involved in Syria?
I don't want any foreign intervention, but I want an end to it. And by all means, I mean, if it takes any foreign intervention, then yes. But it's a shame to see any more lives to be lost. I mean, I would really hope for a political resolution for it. But if it takes military intervention, then the job needs to be done.
Fadi Alderi of the British charity Hand in Hand. Well, for some people, the fact that the Assad regime can bomb its own civilians using horrific but nevertheless conventional weapons brings into even sharper focus the arguments being used for and against military strikes against the Assad regime. Here's the BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen.
In the absence of a UN Security Council resolution, what's being deployed is the argument responsibility to protect citizens. And essentially, that raises, you know, quite an important moral question. is there a difference between deaths caused by chemical weapons and those caused by conventional weapons, or those caused by torture, or by knives, or by clubs? It's still about, if they're talking about civilians, if the responsibility to protect civilians extends to that, then why not protect them?
Well, the architect of the entire responsibility to protect doctrine is the former Australian Foreign Minister Gareth Evans, and he's now Chancellor of the Australian National University in Canberra. When we spoke this morning, I asked him first what he made of last night's vote at Westminster.
I think that's unfortunate. It is rather throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It is important that there be considerable unanimity in the international response to this, and Britain's engagement would have been an important part of that. Clearly, the whole question of whether there's a legal foundation for military action is really needs an enormous amount of debate, because I, for one, am completely underwhelmed by the argument that there is such a foundation that's come out of the British government. I think that's just trying to make things up as it goes along, which has long been the case, and that unless you do get Security Council authority, you just don't have that legal foundation. But that's not the end of the argument. There's a very strong moral case to be made, and most of the necessary criteria were in fact laid out in the British government's statement. The scale, the gravity of the threat to civilians that's involved in the Syrian government action, in particular ratcheting it up with chemical weapons, the fact that there doesn't seem to be any other way of getting the message across to the Syrians that they've got to desist from at least this kind of outrageous behaviour, the necessity for the response to be proportional and so on, and to be properly motivated, all those are proper criteria for saying that such action might be morally legitimate. And I think we ought to keep those arguments very much in play in the days ahead, and not just sort of abandon all hope of sending a very, very strong message to the Syrians, because it is a, if the evidence stands up, it's a gross and unconscionable escalation of what's been a pretty horrible situation already. It's got even worse.
Were you surprised, shocked even, by the decision of the British House of Commons after many years in which Britain has seemed to favour liberal intervention?
Well, I'm just disappointed that the debate has gone off, I think, on the wrong course. I mean, what we need to do is build consensus at all levels about how to approach these issues. And I think by careering off, as we did, the coalition of the willing in 2003 in Iraq, by making up sort of legal arguments for things for which there are no legal foundation, it's made it very difficult to keep a consensus going on this. There is the evidentiary question, which everybody wants to be satisfied about after the debacle in 2003 on that front. But what disappoints me will be the absence of a strong international response, which can probably only take the form now of a military response, to what is a dramatic and horrifying escalation of an already ugly situation with the introduction, apparently, of chemical weapons. And I think it is unfortunate that that Britain's now bailed out of this as a result of the mishandling of the politics of it.
You are convinced that intervention in Syria would be legitimate even if it was not strictly legal?
Yeah, I think those criteria are satisfied, and I think a reasonable case could be made in exactly the same way as it was made in Kosovo. The difficulty here is that we're talking about not a full-scale intervention of the kind we had in Kosovo, but just simply some kind of strike to operate as a deterrent and to ensure that the Assad regime, if it was indeed responsible for this, recognises that there is real pain involved when it does this sort of stuff, and it can't do it in future cost-free. I think it is important for that message to be given. I can't see any other way the message can be given with sanctions or threats of criminal court prosecution and so on. I think it probably does require, at this stage, military action. And I don't think we should be spooked by the absence of Security Council support.
Gareth Evans, the former Australian Foreign Minister. So how has Britain's crucial relationship with the United States been affected by last night's government defeat? I've been talking to one of those who knows the special relationship intimately, General Sir Graham Lamb, former Director of Special Forces, former Commander of the Field Army. After he left the army, he was asked by the Americans to join General McChrystal's team in Afghanistan. How has the transatlantic relationship been changed, I asked him, or damaged?
What it does, it takes us out of the immediate dialogue, which is probably unhelpful. And that doesn't mean we would necessarily have agreed with everything that America may or may not do, or the French. But it does mean that our voice is diminished in this near term on the question of how some form of response could be put together by a coalition of the willing, dependent upon decisions taken, whether it's the UN or as an act by just a few, considering this was the use of chemicals was unacceptable.
Your phrase, it takes us out of the dialogue, does that mean that President Obama simply doesn't need or won't be talking to David Cameron quite as often on the telephone because he's not a staunch ally anymore?
You know, we have stood beside America for a very long time. We took a decision, probably the last grand strategic decision in the 1920s, when we erred in favour of America ahead of Europe. They didn't agree to come in 1939. We didn't agree to join them in Vietnam. They didn't agree with us going into Suez. So, you know, these sort of near-term issues are something which are littered in the past and will be littered in the future. What it means is on the specifics of how, if there was to be a strike and or some sort of military action, how then America would look towards constructing that. There will be a dialogue amongst old friends because we have long-standing relationships in the military, but there won't be the specific cut and thrust of what makes a proportionate sense or a disproportionate use of force.
Does this represent some sort of victory from President Assad because he's managed to divide the international community?
There's a whole range of bad actors out there who will see this as beneficial. He must be feeling, or part of that regime, must be feeling a little bolstered by this particular incident. You know, I'm not necessarily for or against the thought of military intervention. I think we need to get our understanding. You know, if you're in a minefield, you tread carefully. What you should always do is endeavour to get to the other side. In this case, we probably rushed a little soon before we got all the inspectors back, the report completed. We have some of those answers, but we don't have them all. And we do need to get a better understanding. And then we need to take that, build a case with both Parliament and with the people as to why it is absolutely proper that a nation such as ours, who is part of the construct of the international order, who in fact has great standing across the world, the Commonwealth, you name it, a large voice of influence, doesn't somehow think we can just sort of take a backward position and no longer be engaged in international politics on issues of ethical, moral and legal right.
But brutally, it was David Cameron who brought defeat on himself, in your view, because he mishandled the politics of all this, rushed it on an American-driven timetable, and brought this to pass.
No, it was 13 votes. It was really close. He believes passionately in this. Einstein once said, you know, the world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of people who don't do anything about it. Well, David Cameron was bloody well doing something about it. Now, the vote didn't go as he expected. A lot of local party politics playing through, which is rather unworthy of this nation and our politicians. But actually, what's really important is, you know, in this particular case, at this particular time, it didn't work. That doesn't mean we're disengaged or we're out of the game. Quite the opposite.
General Sir Graham Lamb. Well, I'm joined now by Alastair Burt, the Foreign Office Minister responsible for the Middle East. Minister, with the government's Syria policy apparently in tatters, what does this mean for the people of Syria themselves? Because isn't there a real danger that David Cameron has brought upon himself a defeat, which means that President Assad can claim some sort of victory? I've managed to divide and rule my opponents, he can think.
Well, I very much take the line that General Lamb has just taken. David Cameron's not brought this defeat upon himself. In answer to those who wanted to see Parliament having a voice on issues such as this, he rightly returned to Parliament in order to consult them. A week or so after a dreadful incident for which the regime was responsible, and where he believed a strong and quick response was necessary and likely to happen, and therefore wanted to consult Parliament. So we have lost this particular vote, but the policy, the wider policy in relation to Syria to try and encourage negotiations to end the conflict will continue, and so will the narrower policy in terms of trying to ensure that the rest of the world understands how serious a breach of international convention this chemical attack has been, and that the world must say something about it.
Of course you're going to go on working to try and get what's called a Geneva II process, the parties back to the table to talk about a lasting peace in Syria. But surely you can't now come back to the Commons with any sort of proposal requiring a vote to endorse extra support for the rebels, because you're not going to get a vote through the House of Commons.
Well, clearly, unless circumstances change and a different argument can be put over time, then I'm sure what you say is absolutely correct.
But that extra support for the rebels, let's be clear, that was a central plank of yours, of William Hague's entire strategy for British policy towards Syria.
Well, yesterday was a vote about a response to the chemical attack which we believe Assad carried out on his own people on August the 21st. And the motion was very clear in not linking it to anything else in relation to Syria. Our wider policy in relation to Syria, which is well known, which has been to support a lifting of the arms embargo, to encourage support for the moderate opposition, which we've worked at so hard over such a long period, to assist them in being prepared to take part in the Geneva II negotiations, which the joint envoy Lakhdar Brahimi has been working towards, that policy still continues and that will continue. The wider issue of the appalling tragedy of the conflict in Syria, which the United Kingdom has done so much in humanitarian terms to seek to relieve, goes on. And it's very important that people quite rightly focus on what is happening in Syria today and not just the politics of the United Kingdom.
Is Britain going to pursue a draft resolution of the United Nations, or would it be better if someone else sponsored it because your authority has been so damaged by this vote?
I don't think the authority has been damaged. We've been working through the United Nations consistently since this conflict began in order to seek the support of other states and to ensure the Security Council did its job. Now, our feeling very strongly is the Security Council is not functioning in relation to the Syrian conflict, and that is because of the position taken by Russia and China in vetoing attempts to find a way for the international community to do its best to put an end to the conflict. Now, the United Nations has got to see that it has a responsibility here. We will continue to work with others because day by day, as the conflict goes on, the situation there gets worse. The moderate opposition, and it's so easy to fall into Assad's trap of believing it's a choice between him and the extremists. It is not. The moderate opposition want a voice, they need support, and we believe that the international community should seek to give them that support because the longer the conflict goes on, the worse this is for everybody, not least the states surrounding Syria, who are suffering so much with the refugee crisis.
Alistair Burt, is the derailing of British policy towards Syria ultimately the responsibility of the Foreign Secretary William Hague, should he now resign?
There is no derailing of the foreign policy in relation to Syria. What happened last night was the Prime Minister's attempts to get Parliament to see the situation affecting the chemical attack of the 21st of August by the Assad regime on its people in a particular way has not been successful. The wider policy in relation to Syria, which commands the large support of the House of Commons and the British Parliament, to seek a resolution through negotiation of that terrible conflict, to work to support the moderate opposition in non-lethal ways. That policy has been very successful and will continue. But in the end, it is not the United Kingdom that is driving this conflict. It is Assad, it is those who support him, those who are supplying military support to a regime that is killing its own people. And the world needs to wake up to what's happening in Syria and recognise its responsibilities.
Alistair Burt, to many people, last night's defeat for the Prime Minister, for the government and the House of Commons, was a result of a mishandled policy, but also a result of the government and the whips in Parliament failing to read the feelings of Conservative members, both front and backbenchers. Quite a few people on the government payroll failed to vote for the resolution, for the motion.
Well, again, in terms of British politics, people can't have it both ways. You either want a government that respects Parliament, and when asked at the beginning of the summer whether it would be recalled if circumstances required it, did so. In circumstances which were very swift after the chemical attack, you can't have a situation where people want that to happen, and then when it does, and when Parliament is listened to, and people express their opinion, somehow claim it's some sort of mistake. The Prime Minister listened to the views both of opposition and of Conservative members in putting together the motion, but in the end, Parliament has spoken. It wasn't with the voice that the government wanted, but we live in a parliamentary democracy, and the government works with Parliament and respects the will of the Parliament, and we will take foreign policy forward on the basis of what the Parliament has said about this chemical attack, and we'll continue with our wider policy efforts to support the people of Syria who are being so miserably persecuted by their own regime.
Alistair Burt, Foreign Office Minister, thank you very much indeed. Now, in his award-winning translation of the Anglo-Saxon epic Beowulf, Seamus Heaney wrote of the clear song of a skilled poet telling with mastery of man's beginnings. Well, he could almost have been writing about himself. The poet, who died today at the age of 74, was acclaimed by many as the greatest Irish poet since W.B. Yeats. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1995 for works of lyrical beauty and ethical depth which exalt everyday miracles and the living past.
Little adulteress, before they punished you, you were flaxen-haired, undernourished, and your tar-black face was beautiful. My poor scapegoat, I almost love you, but would have cast, I know, the stones of silence.
Well, I'm joined now by Matthew Hollis, the poetry editor at Faber and Faber, who worked with Seamus Heaney for many years. Your memories and thoughts about Seamus Heaney?
I suppose the first thoughts of so many of us, both at Faber's and in the poetry community, are actually extended to Seamus's devoted and loving family on this very difficult day. And as you said at the beginning, he was for many of us the poet of our age, a writer of international gifts, but a man of a kind of hearthside, homespun personal kindness, whose kindness touched very many of us in great ways. He was rather a father figure for this poetry community, and if you like, he was the head of our poetry household.
For what do you think will Seamus Heaney be most remembered? Was it his entirely original approach to poetry? Was it the music of his language? What was it?
So many things. He brought vigour to the language, as you said. I suppose one of the things I think of it is that he brought the light with him somehow in every conversation you had with him. In every line of verse that you read, it was like a mystical thread that left the world a better place than it began when you started to read it. I think his opening up of the English language, and you mentioned Beowulf, woke something in the soul of the English language that perhaps some of us had forgotten existed, and something that burnt rich and deeply, and that broadened it and deepened it as well. He brought dexterity into English language, I think.
I'm not going to talk about Irish politics, but the fact is Seamus Heaney was a very unusual poet in the context of these two islands of ours, wasn't he?
I think he's a deeply unusual poet in these two islands and internationally, as I said. He showed countless readers, I think, what was possible in the language and what was valuable as well. He was a man that managed to take people with him, and that is one of the great soul arts of poetry. After all, it's a form of storytelling and it is a form of community, and I think Seamus, better than most, understood and expressed that so well.
In a few words, if you were urging someone who's never read Seamus Heaney to sample a piece of his work, where would you point them?
Well, one of the great joys of Seamus's work is that every page opens a door, and I think you can start anywhere. You mentioned Beowulf, and that's a terrific place to start, but why not start at the beginning with Death of a Naturalist, his first book in 1966, and work your way through? I think we all feel that today poetry is poorer for Seamus's passing, but what I have to remind myself of is that we will go back to his poems today and tomorrow and the day after, and he will stay a constant companion in his work to all of us.
Matthew Hollis, the poetry editor at Faber and Faber, on the poet Seamus Heaney, who died today. Thank you very much indeed. Well, a new chief rabbi will take over from Lord Sacks on Sunday. Rabbi Ephraim Mervis, a South African by birth, has been in charge of two major London synagogues, and he's a former chief rabbi of Ireland. He will lead what's called the United Hebrew Congregations of the Commonwealth, essentially mainstream Orthodox Judaism. Our religious affairs correspondent, Robert Piggott, has been speaking to him.
The chief rabbi, or the chief rabbinate, is a unique institution. Since 1704, there have just been 10 chief rabbis before me. I am the 11th. You know, more than 50 prime ministers have come and gone, and the chief rabbinate is a respected voice. So certainly I would like to take advantage of that through my chief rabbinate.
Will it be a voice for conserving what is good about society or acknowledging that society needs to move on?
Both. I mean, we've got a great society, and Britain is a wonderful country. I believe we should celebrate everything that is positive and always recognise that there's a huge amount more that we should be doing.
I suppose I raise that question because within your own community there's pressure, isn't there, for change. Pressure from women in particular to be better recognised for their role in Judaism and in the life of synagogues. Can you offer them any sign of hope for a fuller role?
Within our communities we're seeing huge vitality, many congregations which are bursting with highly successful programs, and here and there we are thinning out. There are those who are calling for some elements of change, and we've already seen a lot that has been done. I am delighted, for example, that the United Synagogue recently announced that women can become chairman of congregations, and as a result we already have a number of women who are now the leaders of their communities.
Why not women rabbis?
In our tradition, men have occupied that role, and that is the format for Orthodox congregations.
The liberal and reform groups of rabbis, they seem to be growing and thriving in this country, those two movements, they are pushing for a softer line on homosexuality and on the issue of gender. Aren't you dragging your feet? Aren't you out of step with mainstream thinking in society on issues such as gender and sexuality?
I would like all Jewish men and women to know, regardless of their feelings, their actions, they have a home within our synagogues, and we will always make every single one of them welcome.
Making them welcome in a synagogue isn't the same thing as that question, though, is it? It's the question of whether you would support full equality for those people in society at large.
We have a very clear biblical definition of marriage, which is the union of one man and one woman. And through that, we value traditional family life. But I would like to reiterate our genuine sentiment to every single Jewish man and woman: you have a home in our synagogues, and we will make you feel comfortable, regardless of who you are.
A home, but with limits according to your tradition.
Equality is what we strive for. But when we talk about equality, it's not uniformity. When it comes, for example, to men and for women and the opportunity within synagogues and within community life, there are clear roles that different people can play, and in that way, each one can actually achieve his or her own amazing potential.
One bone of contention with the reform and liberal groups is that you, or your predecessors at least, haven't ever been into a reform or liberal synagogue and haven't really regarded their rabbis as fully equal. Will you go to reform and liberal synagogues?
There are many ways in which we can express friendship and togetherness. And as the incoming chief rabbi, I extend a hand of warmth, of friendship, to my colleagues who are in movements outside of the Orthodox movement. And I would like them to know I'd like to work closely with them. Unity of the Jewish people is of enormous importance. We have enough problems from those on the outside. Within our own ranks, we need to build on that which unites us, and not to concentrate so much on that which separates us. I am totally committed and dedicated to working with the non-Orthodox community, and they will find in me a friend, somebody who is genuinely willing to work together with them at all times.
The new Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis talking to Robert Piggott. Now, for the last in our series of diaries from Robin Lustig. Over the past 4 weeks, we've followed him walking the length of the River Thames, from its source in the Cotswolds to the estuary at Woolwich.
And here I am at the Thames Barrier at Woolwich. For me, after 184 miles of walking over 15 days, it's journey's end. For London, it's an essential protection against the risk of potentially devastating tidal floods. I've never seen these huge stainless steel shells so close up before. They do look strangely alien, otherworldly, as if some extraterrestrial life form has plonked them down across this greatest of rivers. Downstream from here, there's the estuary and then the sea. Upstream, all the way back to that tiny stream that I walked beside in a muddy Cotswold meadow, villages, towns, cities, much of England's history. Ancient towns like Wallingford and Abingdon, historic castles and palaces. I feel a sense of achievement having made it all the way. I know I haven't exactly climbed Mount Everest or cycled from Land's End to John O'Groats, but I have got to know the River Thames, and that was the aim of the exercise. I've seen its first faltering gurgles, its tentative meanderings through the Gloucestershire countryside, then its ever more confident adolescence and adulthood through Oxfordshire and Berkshire and Surrey. I've seen the most ridiculously opulent riverside residences, and as I've passed through London, I've seen the extraordinary transformation of places like Battersea, Vauxhall and London Bridge, where apartment blocks, offices and walkways are breathing new life into what were derelict wharves and warehouses. I do feel just a little bit sad that my journey has ended, but I will see plenty more of the river in the years to come, of course. After all, I am still a Londoner. But from now on, every time I cross a bridge over the Thames or take a walk along one of its banks, I think I may be tempted just to whisper a little greeting.
Hi there, River Thames. Remember me? We did get to know each other quite well, once upon a time.
Robin Lustig with slightly sore feet, I imagine. Well, it brings us to today's closing headlines. David Cameron says Britain will continue to provide a robust response to the suspected chemical weapons attack in Syria last week, despite the Commons vote last night against military involvement. The Conservative former Shadow Home Secretary David Davis told us the Prime Minister made a shaky argument and had suffered a setback. This is James Robbins, and that's The World at 1:45.
You can find more podcasts of documentaries and current affairs at bbc.co.uk/radio4.